diagrams?
No diagrams.
There you go.
Hey, family. My name is Brendan Ferrer. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 28th, 1987. And as I mentioned, my home group is Seattle Men's. We meet at 7:30 on Monday nights. And all of you that wish to attend are welcome to attend. My wife just sent me a text. She was chairing a meeting, actually, about an hour ago online. And she said, will you get a tape of your bit? And I said, for God's sakes, why? We've been married for almost 30 years. You've heard my bit more times than I can count. She goes, yeah, but it's different every time. And I was like, no shit. Okay, good to know. So I always start with this. What I'm going to talk about is my story. It's my opinions based on my experience. If you have a different experience, that's fantastic. My opinions are just mine, so don't take it personal. And if you need to talk to your sponsor afterwards, please feel free. So I got sober by accident. It was, just a series of misadventures that I thought I would, go to treatment and get out from underneath what was troubling me, and then everything would be fine. Had no intention of staying sober. My sobriety date happens to be my birthday because I was pretty sure I didn't get loaded on my birthday or thereafter. But since I wasn't planning on getting sober, I didn't really keep track of it. So for many years when I did my bit, I talked a lot about my family of origin, because they're far more interesting than I am. Mike said that I should just, or I think it was Eric said, I should just tell stories about my dad's for the first half hour, get you guys rolling, because he's hysterical. So we might have some Michael moments, that's who my father is. But I'll try and keep it confined to mine. I'm shockingly nervous, which is weird for me. I don't usually get nervous when I do my bit. So bear with me if I stumble, and we'll go from there. So I come from four generations of alcoholics. The fifth generation back died before my grandfather was an adult from alcoholism. And in that case, it was actually cholera, but that's a whole nother story. My grandfather got sober in 1978, and my father got sober the first time in the same time that I did. For me, I believe in the generational nature of this disease. So that's my experience. I have no idea why I'm an alcoholic and don't really care. Spent a lot of time in the program trying to figure that out, figure out that locus point, that one moment where everything changed. And then I realized it didn't really matter. It wasn't going to inform what was going to happen next. But I was, like most alcoholics in my experience, we're always looking for a reason, right? If I had just done this, this would be different. So growing up, I went to 27 schools by the time I graduated in high school in 5 states. My dad was, somebody's like, was your dad in the Navy? I said, no, my dad was a dirtbag itinerant, laborer and drug dealer. So you move a lot, just ahead of whatever's gonna happen next. My father to this day swears he never went to jail, but I distinctly remember watching him get bailed out when I was like 6 years old. So, my dad and mom were 17 and 18 when I was born. I was a second kid. They met in a shooting gallery in Denver in the late 60s. And so, there wasn't a lot of hope. And I carried that resentment for literally decades in this program because I couldn't figure out what my part was, I had a terrible childhood. Great. What's my part? And about 5 or 6 years ago, I was at a meeting in LA, and this woman was speaking from the podium. And this has not happened to me before, and hopefully it won't happen to me again. I'm sitting in this meeting, and so I'll set the stage. It's the Malibu Speakers Meeting on Saturday night, so it's about 200 people. It's in Malibu, right? So it's I have a lot of judgment about that. So I'm wearing all my motorcycle gear, and I'm a hard guy, right? So I show up at Malibu, and it's, 200 drunks walking around, and the first speaker gives his bit, and it was what I was expecting. It was a dude who was in the industry in Hollywood, and he's talking about how important he is. And so I'm like, this is gonna be great. This fits all of my judgments and all the profiles that I'm looking for. And this woman gets up and talks, and about 10 minutes into her bit, I started crying. And I cried for 10 minutes in that meeting, just could not stop crying. Because she gave me something I'd never heard in this program before, and she said that, what's your part in your resentments toward your parents? What's your expectation, What did you expect 17 and 8-year-old dirtbags were gonna be like for parents? And that just for that healed decades of upset and frustration and anger in an instant. And that's why I started crying. So, you know, being born into that kind of, you know, lifestyle, you know, some of you probably experienced it. It's, you know, it's a lot of chaos and a lot of fear and a lot of upset. And, you know, a lot of, for me, just terror. You know, so that's not why I drank. I drank because that's what my family does. But it certainly helped. I will say that. You know, being numb from the, you know, from the neck up is something that, you know, I like a lot. That's why I'm here. So, you know, growing up in that family, I got four brothers and sisters. There's five kids, four dads. You know, and just it's a Jerry Springer episode every day, right? And you know, of those kids, four of us are alcoholics. One of us is a hardcore member of Al-Anon. I'm the only sober one. My other three siblings are out there doing what they do, you know, and functioning at the level that they can function. So I love them, but I don't spend a lot of time around them because they're not super nice people. So I spent, I started using drugs and drinking when I was a kid, like a little kid, because that's what my family did. You know, my dad says that when I was a kid, he used to feed me Quaaludes and warm milk because it would put me to sleep, and I was a colicky baby, and I think you go to jail for that now. Back then, that was just parenting, and, you know, so again, what was my expectation? That they were going to do better, you know, so fast forward, I was in my, you know, just before I turned into a teenager, my father had married his second wife. And we'd moved to Arizona. I grew up here when I was a kid, so I lived, if there's a shithole town between, you know, Seattle and the California border that has logging or some kind of manual labor in it, we lived in it. Reedsport, Coos Bay, you know, just, you know, Longview, my personal favorite. if you're wondering if it was any nicer in the 70s, it was not. It was just as nasty as it is now. We lived in a railroad shack right next to the bridge there when I was a kid. And, you know, some of the stuff that kind of happened when I was a kid is like, you know, we were living in that railroad shack right next to the bridge in Longview on the Washington side. And the dudes next to us were dope dealers. And they got, you know, they got killed and their house was burned down, right? And so this was just a normal Saturday night in my life. And, you know, I didn't realize it left scars until I was an adult and had to deal with that. But, you know, for me, that was just kind of the normal course of events. So when my dad remarried, we moved to Arizona, which I hated at the time, because, you know, if you come from the Northwest and you move to Arizona, it's hot there. And, you know, I was used to being the new kid, so that didn't really freak me out. And I rapidly found some dudes that kind of like to do the stuff that I like to do. And, you know, several of those guys are in the program now in my hometown, which is really funny. And, you know, there's not much interesting about it. For me, you know, I've spent the bulk of my life sober. I've been sober for 37 years, you know. I know a lot about this program. I know a lot about what it took for me to get here. When I was, you know, practicing and using, I fell down a well, you know, I got arrested. I did all the stuff that we do, you know. It's pretty dull and uninteresting. And, you know, when I got here, I just didn't think I had enough road wear to really qualify for Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought, you know, this was a program for people that really had a problem. I just had a living problem. I didn't have a drinking problem. And so my father got sober because I think his second wife had left him or who knows, you know. He's been married six times at this point, so he's still giving that a college try. But I think he's been unmarried now for a number of years, which is probably a good thing. So he got sober, and I had no place to go. And I was given a choice. I could, I was living in a shelter on the east side of Tucson in a religious, for a church that did the, you know, Wednesday service, Thursday service, Friday service. And you had, you know, we called it singing for your supper. You had to go to church in order to live there. And I was not, I'd never been to the church. It wasn't my thing. So I'm living in this, basically, I just think of it as Christian flop house, you know, eating government cheese and freezer burned ice cream. And you know, I was like, this sucks. You know, this is definitely not what I want to be doing. And so they said, you can continue to do this, you can get out, or you can get sober. And for me, it was the easier, softer way. You know, it's like, oh, I can go to treatment. Great. You know, what they didn't tell me is after I got out of treatment, I was going to go to treatment again, which was, I would have probably made a different decision. So I ended up in an inpatient treatment in Tucson, Arizona called West Center. They had an adolescent program back then. This is the 80s, so insurance was paid for full treatment centers. So it was just a revolving door of kids coming in and out. And funny story was 2 years before I got sober, my wife got sober. We didn't know each other. And she went to the same treatment center, which is, you know, kind of one of those little like, oh, no shit. So I'm in treatment. I'm thinking, you know, I don't really belong here. I hadn't really understood that normal people didn't think like I did about drugs and alcohol. That wasn't what they did. But because of the way I grew up and the people I spent time with, that was the norm. The norm was not good grades and a white picket fence. It was, you know, desperation and stupid and small and petty and criminal and just shitty. And so, you know, when I got to treatment, you know, I had 3 meals a day. I wasn't living in a Christian shelter. Nobody was trying to fuck with me. And I was safe. And I was like, this doesn't suck as bad as I thought it would. So I can play this game for a while, and then I can go do what it is that I like to do, you know, whatever that is. And while I was in treatment, my old man got in a bicycle accident. And I always say this, and you hear it's great in certain meetings, you hear this, oh, but my dad died. But they brought him back, and he died, and they brought him back, and he died. And so he did this like 4 or 5 times. But he had a traumatic brain injury, so he couldn't take care of me. So, you know, I'm getting ready to get out of treatment. I got no place to go again. And my grandfather, who's a member of this program at that point for about 9 years, said, hey, there's a treatment center in Oklahoma City that he can live in for the next 6 months. And I thought, that sounds horrible, you know. I don't know if anybody here has ever been to Oklahoma City. If you look up Garden Spot, it's not in the dictionary next to Garden Spot. You know, so I'm moving to Oklahoma in October, right? So I'd never heard the words ice storms or, you know, understood what it meant to be sheet ice covering an entire city. And I didn't own a jacket because I lived in Tucson. We owned flip-flops and board shorts. And but I had no place else to go. And so I was like, yeah, I can do this for a little while, play the game, you know, get back to doing what I like to do. And, you know, for me, I like to drink. I like to smoke weed. I like to take any substance that does something to me that makes the magic happen, you know. The doctor's opinion describes it well. Right? I have no idea what's going to happen when I put drugs and alcohol in my system. I don't care either. That's kind of the key point for me, is I don't really care. I'm not interested in consequences, I just don't care. And you know, somebody in a meeting described it, that first drink, where you feel your toes tingle and it kind of works its way up your body until your nose starts to tingle. And I'd never heard that before. And I was like, oh, yeah, I know exactly what that's like. I know exactly what that feeling is. And if that feeling could be guaranteed for me the rest of life, I would have zero use for this program. But it doesn't work that way, at least not for me. So here I am in Oklahoma City. I'm 15 years old. I got no place to go. And I'm in a halfway house for adults. And I'm a kid. And you know, I was terrified. But I was also pretty accustomed to this, because this had been the way I'd lived most of my life. And so the funny thing about that is I was born in Oklahoma City. I got sober in Oklahoma City. About 2 blocks from where I was born is where I got sober, you know. And so for me, my God's got a really twisted sense of humor. Yours may be kind, loving, and gentle. Mine's kind of an asshole, like I am. And it's my God after all, so how could it be any different? And so, you know, the kismet for me is here I am living in this, at that time it still is pretty rough, but then it was a straight up ghetto. I mean, like, you know, weeds growing out of the sidewalks, abandoned buildings, which is why you put a halfway house there, because it's cheap. And this guy named Gene Johnson started a program called Freedom of Choice. And obviously, we immediately renamed it Freedom from Choice, because they were lockdown facilities. And I lived there for almost 2 years, you know. And if it wasn't for that, there's zero chance I would probably be standing here today, right? You know, I lived in that halfway house in a group setting. And again, some things became really clear, like I could go to school. There was food in the refrigerator. Nobody was messing with me, you know. I didn't have to worry about what was going to happen the next day. I knew I could come home from school and go to this place and be safe. And for me, that was a miracle, right? Because I'd never had that. And, you know, so I thought, this isn't bad, you know. This isn't as bad as what I had before. I still didn't think I was an alcoholic, still didn't want to be sober, but I definitely liked the fact that my life wasn't raining shit every day. So, you know, they told me it was a 6-month program. Turned out it was like 20 months. My father likes to say that some are sicker than others, and he might be right. I think he just, you know, quite frankly, I didn't have anywhere else to go. And when I was sober about a year, at the Western Club in Oklahoma City, it's a really big room, it's about 3 times the size, and they have a Thursday night meeting, and you walk, you know, from the back of the room to the front of the room, and there's 3 steps up, and there's a podium, and that's where you get your chip. And they would haul like 60 of us to this meeting every week. And, you know, if you got 60 teenagers chanting the entire the whole How It Works when people would read it, because we were required to memorize it. So you get this group of little shitbags sitting in the corner, and we'd all be, you know, parroting the guy at the microphone. It drove the old timers nuts, so that made it actually really entertaining and a lot of fun. Plus, you could still smoke in meetings, so you couldn't actually see the front of the room from the back of the room. And they had this little glassed-in cubicle on the side where the non-smokers would sit and look out the window, you know. You kind of look over like, oh, you poor bastards. And so I got my first chip at that meeting. I got a 1-year chip. And I noticed that my life was better, you know. I had, I was safe, you know. And I felt like a part of something, which was something that had never happened for me. I still hadn't worked the steps. You know, I'd go to meetings. You know, at the time I went to school and I'd go to work. And, you know, I'd come home to the halfway house. And my father had a great idea when I was 16. He put me up for adoption. And it says a lot about my old man, you know. He was desperate to get out from underneath having kids. And it was, you know, it's one of those weird experiences that, you know, I thought didn't leave any scars like so many of the other things. But I lasted a month in this couple's house, and I was such a savage little shithead that they sent me back, right? And I was, that had never happened to me before, right? I was used to not getting my way. I was used to not being comfortable. But to have somebody say, you're so broken that we can't have you in our house, was like, whoa. Now, that didn't inform my behavior. I didn't change anything, mind you, because, you know, why would you change? Everything's fine. But when I went back into that treatment center, I did my first fifth step. You know, I wrote a 4-step out, and I did my first fifth step. And for me, you know, not being a member of the church, this group would send you to a priest to do your deal, right? And, you know, I was kind of fascinated because Oklahoma City has a lot of rough areas, but they also have some really, really beautiful areas. And so I go to this classic, you know, granite church, stained glass windows. The priest's like 6'2", iron gray hair, steel blue eyes, just rugged. And you're just like, whoa, this is super cool. So I go in and I do my bit. And I finish my bit and I'm sitting on the sidewalk, sitting on the stairs out front waiting for my ride. It's sunny, it's beautiful outside, and I felt for the first time in my life, just a moment of peace, right? I felt clean for the first time. You know, that moment where I didn't feel dirty on the inside. I didn't feel like a piece of shit, you know? And I didn't do anything after that, mind you. I didn't do the 6, 7, 8, or 9. I just, you know, but I got that far. And when I was 17, I moved home. And I moved back in with my old man. And I started going to meetings in Tucson where we were living at the time. And there was, you know, we each get, maybe you don't, I have heroes that happen for me consistently throughout my sobriety. When I got sober, it was the woman that ran the halfway house. She was a member of Al-Anon, which I didn't have any experience with. And she was a professional counselor. And she was the woman that kind of pulled me back and said, you know, you can have a life beyond what you grew up with. You're not assigned to this, man. This isn't your destiny. You can be something different, but that's kind of up to you. And I was like, yada, 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 yada. But it stuck, right? It stuck in there somewhere. And so I moved home. My dad's house where he was moving me into wasn't ready, and so I lived with his then girlfriend, who was also a professional. She was a drug and alcohol counselor. She'd been sober about 10 years. What she was doing with my old man is anybody's guess, dude, because he was a trash fire. And this woman actually was really, really impressive. And so I lived with her, and I had the first time I ever celebrated Christmas was with her. And you know, I was living in her guest bedroom, and Christmas was coming up, and I said, hey, you know, I can leave for the day because, you know, I know you got your kids coming over. And she just kind of looked at me like, you know, the fuck is wrong with you? And I said, well, you know, I don't want to be in the way. Your family's coming over. She goes, well, you know, you're living in my house. You're part of my family. You're going to come to Christmas. And then I didn't know what to do, right? I'm like, how do you show up for Christmas, right? For me, holidays and family gatherings were not times of peace and joy, right? In fact, I was 25 years sober before I could sit down at a table with my wife and kids and have a meal without feeling uncomfortable, right? Because to me, when you would sit down at a table, it was usually somebody else's table and you were eating off of their food because you didn't have anything to eat, or it was my family, which meant that somebody was going to get in a fist fight, something bad was going to happen. That was a guarantee. It happened every time. So I was a long time sober before I actually understood that my reaction to try, when my wife would say, hey, why don't we sit down and have dinner? I would literally go like, no, that's good. I'm good. I'm going to just go eat in front of the TV, you know? And she would comment on it, you know, and I didn't have an answer. And then one day I realized that for me, that was a terrifying experience, right? I had to ride motorcycles at the track and, you know, do all kinds of really cool shit, but I couldn't sit at a table and eat a meal with my kids. And you know, this woman kind of introduced me to the thought process that, like, hey, your life doesn't have to be a dumpster fire all the time, right? You can have nice things. You can be a human being of decent standing. She had a note on her refrigerator. Her name's Lynn Griffin. She died about 3 years ago. She had a note on her fridge that said, she had food in her fridge too, which was a really cool thing because I was not accustomed to that, right? It said, the woman I am will drink again. And I said, what does that mean? She goes, the person I was not going to ever be capable to stand sober. You know, you have to change. You have to be different. And, you know, so she cared for me. And that was one of my second heroes in this program, you know. Without her, that transition from being in long-term treatment to being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous would have been really difficult. I'd never been to an Alcathon. She took me to an Alcathon on Christmas and introduced me to some of her friends. You know, and some of those people are still alive, and I still see them when I go home. And she introduced me to a man named Jack Downey. Jack Downey ran the halfway house my dad lived in when he was getting sober. And he was a divisive figure in Tucson AA. He was meaner than shit, crude, and brilliant, right? And he had a brand of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know they had brands. You know, I just thought AA was AA, but he had his own brand. He was a former cowboy and concrete guy. And he started a house for alcoholics when he got sober, and he started one for men and one for women, and helped literally thousands of men and women get sober. And you know, he said, if you can feed an alcoholic and give him a safe place to live, they have a fighting chance, right? So that was his goal. I didn't realize how brilliant that was until I realized those are the things that kept me here, is I had a safe place to be and I got fed, you know, and I was a damn sight better than I'd had. So, you know, now I'm 17, 18 years old. I'm losing my fucking mind because I haven't worked the steps and I haven't done anything. And I certainly had no experience with God. I was a really, really, really angry atheist and loved to talk about it in meetings, you know. Because keep in mind, this is the late 80s, early 90s at this point, and so there's still a lot of young people coming into AA. And so they had young people's conventions, and I would go to the local Alano Club, and all the people that I knew were in their 40s, right? Because that's who Leonard introduced me to. And so there's this young group of people, including this really hot chick with blonde hair and a short black dress, who I'm now married to. And that kept me going to meetings for a while, I won't lie. And, you know, so I'm arguing about God with everybody that I meet. Because, you know, if there's a God, how can I have the life I had? If there's a God, you know, why did I have to sing for my supper? If there's a God, you know, why was I born into this? This is insane. And I went to college and studied religion and philosophy so I could argue better. And because I really, really was pissed off about it. Didn't know I was pissed off about it, but I was pissed off about it. So I'm 18 years old. I'm 3 years sober. I'm losing my mind. And then I started dating who later turned out to be a crack addict. Who knew? You know, I mean, this gal from the local coffee shop. And my life went to shit, you know, because I don't have a program. I'm going to about 3 meetings a week. I don't have a sponsor. I went to the same meetings, and so I knew some people, but I didn't have any kind of recovery at all. You know, somebody defined sobriety for me as soundness of mind. You know, we define it in this program as absence from alcohol, drugs, and substances. This person defined it as soundness of mind, and I'd never heard that before, and I certainly didn't have that. They said, that's what recovery is when your brain's not firing all the time and making you crazy, you know. That's sobriety. And I said, that doesn't sound very interesting. So, you know, there's girls and there's motorcycles and there's stuff that's far more important. And so, you know, I did that for a couple years and got to the point where I was sleeping outside with a loaded gun in my backpack because I couldn't stand being around other people. And I didn't know what to do. You know, I had no idea what to do. I'd made a couple friends in AA. I had a friend in AA. And we would spend time together and talk about how everybody else sucked. And, you know, we'd go to some meetings, especially if there were girls there. And we were just feral, you know, like a couple of feral cats running around. And I just lost my shit, you know, and spent a couple of years in some, you know, pretty dark places. And then I had a bright idea that my life would get better if I went to work up in Alaska. So I took a job on a trawler out of Dutch. Funny story about that, Mark Rose and I worked on the same boat at different times, you know, which is, you know, there's a lot of boats on Dutch. So the fact that that happened is another one of those kind of weird coincidences that my life seems to be made up of. And so I worked on that boat for 4 months and something magic happened for me. I was taken away from all the stuff that was, you know, girls and all the stuff that I thought was super important. And all I had to do was work. You know, you work 16 hours a day, 17 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I worked all the anger and piss and rage I had out of me in 4 months, right? It just left because all I had to do was show up and do this job. And I can do that, right? Like, I can shut my brain off and do a thing in front of me. And having that kind of respite where my brain could reset let me come back into the life I was living and have a fighting chance, you know. Now, I still wasn't willing to work the steps or talk about God, but I could sit in a meeting without having my skin crawl, right? I could sit in rooms with other people and not be full of rage. And, you know, that was the gift that the God I didn't believe in gave me, was I had just enough space to kind of find some breathing room. And, you know, during that period of time, I met the woman I'm married to. I had actually met her when I was 17, but she didn't want anything to do with me, and rightfully so. In fact, I called her one time, and she got off the phone with me and called one of our friends, and she said, "What's wrong with that guy?" And his response was, "Have you met his old man?" She's like, "Yeah." She goes, "Oh, that makes a lot of sense." You know, so we started dating, and she was an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she had started the first Young People's Convention in Arizona, which is now ASCIPAW. Back then it was called YES, Youth Enjoying Sobriety. We called it Youth Enjoying Sex, Syphilis, and Sobriety. You know, but I found some litter mates that I hadn't had since I'd gotten sober. When I was living in treatment, I had people that I spent time with every day. And we called them litter mates, right? They're the people you kind of grow up with. And so I had that again. And it was magic, man. You know, we moved in together. We were both going to college. Our house was full of people in the program all the time, you know. And we got married in 1995, so this year will be 30 years, which I still don't totally grasp how long that is. But and I was she went to meetings and she had a sponsor and she worked the steps and she read the big book and she did prayer and meditation. And I didn't, but we made that work, you know. And then she graduated from college and said, hey, I want to move to Seattle and go to med school. And I was like, yeah, all right, I'm ready to go. I want to leave Tucson. So I came to Seattle and you all do everything wrong. You know, meetings are an hour and a half. It's fucking dark at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It rains 200 days a year. People are not the most friendly. I just have to say that, you know. I'd walk into a meeting and, you know, people would just look at me. And I was like, well, actually, in point of fact, they probably weren't looking at me. But I was certain because I was so important that they were paying attention to me. And so I went to meetings a little bit. And then, you know, I remember this very well. I was at Counterbalance on Wednesday nights. I was about 10 years sober, and this little gal came in. She's about this tall. Her name is Virginia. Some of you guys might know her. And Ginny was trying to get sober, right? And you know, at this point, I thought people that relapsed were losers, because you know, if I can do this, look at me, I'm great. I'm 10 years sober. Everything's fine. I haven't worked the steps. Don't have a sponsor. Don't believe in God. But I'm good. I'm good. Just ask me. I'll tell you. And when I would speak in meetings, it was just garbage, just anger, just, you know, so much hate. And I wanted to drink, you know. I wanted to do anything just to stop the pain I was feeling. So I'm at this meeting, and this gal comes in, and every week she would come in. This was over the course of like 3 or 4 months. And she's a butch lesbian, which I had a lot of judgment about. She was tiny, and she would talk for 20 minutes. And she would just go, dude, and it was painful. It's just like a rambling diatribe about how, you know, how it's everybody else's fault. But during that period of time, she started to turn green, right? Because she was dying of alcoholism. Her liver was shutting down. She was dying of alcoholism. She's like 26 years old. And, you know, this tiny little thing. And I'm just watching this, right? And that was the first chink in the armor of my judgment, right? Because she wanted what I had. She didn't want what I had, but she wanted the sobriety, right? Nobody wanted it. I didn't want what I have. How would anybody else want it? Shockingly, nobody asked me to sponsor him at the time. Go figure. And so I'm watching this gal, and she's dying of this disease. And she desperately wants something that I have and don't want, not grateful for, have no grace, right? And it changed my life, right? Watching this woman try and get sober, you know, and being unable to do so was an experience I'd never paid any attention to. But because she would talk for 20 minutes at every meeting, you couldn't avoid listening to her, right? Unless you left the meeting. And I see Jeff's over there is nodding his head because I think he might have been at some of those meetings. And so, you know, that was the first chink in the armor is, okay, you know, like you have something truly gifted. You've forgotten. You forgot what pain and rage is. You forgot what living like an animal is. You forgot all of that. And so you're sitting here, you got a wife in med school, you got a job, you like what you're doing, everything's great. And you're dying, man. You're fucking dying. And this woman is doing the same thing, except she can't get sober, you know. Fast forward, I think she's 20 some odd years sober at this point, and a remarkable human being. I saw her in a meeting about 10 years later, and I started crying, right? Because I was like, I can't believe you're still alive. She became another one of my heroes, man. Because she made it, you know. And as far as I know, I think she still lives out on the east side, or out in east of the mountains, and is still sober. You know, so I didn't know what to do. You know, it's 2000, it's the year 2000. I met a dude in a bicycle riding club that, you know, we went to dinner at his house, and he's got a big book on his table, and my wife and I, like, hey, are you a member of the program? And he's like, yeah, would you like to go to Abigail's Ghost? And he said, why don't you come down and chair the meeting? And, you know, I had a lot to say. None of it was good, but I had a lot to say. And so I go to this meeting, and there's a guy named John M. who was a cop at the time. I think some of you know John. And he would talk in this meeting, and I hated that fucking guy. I didn't like cops that much to begin with, and everything that came out of his mouth was just like, nah, nah, nah. And so, I go to this meeting, because I don't know what else to do, because I'm either going to drink, commit suicide, I'm definitely getting a divorce in the very near future, and my life's just going to crap, and I don't know what to do, right? And I'd been living like this for 5 or 6 years at this point, right? I'd lost my litter mates because I moved up here, didn't like your program, Wine. And so I'm sitting in this meeting, but I kept going to Abigail's Ghost because it was convenient, right? And, you know, I like a meeting that gets me full of rage. It always kind of, you know, ups the tempo a little bit. So, you know, if I couldn't listen, I could at least be judgmental. And back then it was in the Center for Wooden Boats, and the meeting faced east. Later it faced west, but at this point it still faced east. And so I'm sitting in this meeting, I'm getting ready to go on a motorcycle trip. My wife's getting ready to leave me, you know. I'm dying, I'm thinking drinking or suicide's a much better alternative to what I'm doing. And the sun's coming up over Cap Hill, and I hear this voice in my head that says, you fucking tried everything else. You better find a God or you're gonna fucking die. And I'm like, whoa. You know, they say God lives within you, so really it could be a voice in your head, and think about that for a second, you know. But it just created another chink in my armor. And so I took off on that trip, and I spent, you know, 6 weeks riding motorcycles down to Mexico, and I sat inside my helmet, and I screamed at God every day for like 6 weeks, right? Because I just couldn't get it. I was keeping a secret. I didn't think I belonged in this program. I didn't know what to do, and I heard you guys talk, and you sounded like you were sane. And I just don't know that I wanted that, but it just sounded better than what I was sitting on. And I came back from that meeting, and my wife, I left the motorcycle down in Arizona, and my wife picked me up at the train station, and she was late. My wife is always late. I don't know if you have this with your spouses or not. Drives me absolutely crazy. So now, you know, I haven't seen my wife in 6 weeks. She's late. I'm sitting in front of the King's, you know, the King Street station, just stewing. God damn it, she's never on time. And she pulls up in our little diesel rabbit, and she says, how was your trip? And I said, it was good. Yeah, it was fine. And we're kind of quiet, and we're driving home to Ballard, and she says, you know, how was your trip? And I said, well, you know, I kind of spent a lot of time talking to God. And she burst into tears. She said, man, I was fucking sure you're gonna die. I was sure of it. And I was like, what? What are you talking about? Everything's fine, you know? She's like, man, you're so fucked up, you don't even know how fucked up you are. And I was like, yeah, that's probably true. And a little later that week, she took me to the Thursday Night Magnolia meeting. Up on, which is not there anymore, but, and we walked in, and there's Claude V and Bob H are sitting right inside the door. If you ever went to that meeting back then, they'd sit right on the little pew next to the door. You know, Claude's got palsy, Bob's on an oxygen tank. He wasn't yet in a wheelchair, but he was in an he had an oxygen tank. And, you know, they walk in, and I'm skittish like a cat, man, because I've got God. I know I need to be in the program. I'm desperate to not die. But I don't know what to do. And these two guys, you know, Claude stands up and he's shaking and he puts his hand out. He says, hi, I'm Claude. And I was like, my first thought was, why the fuck are you talking to me? Because I'd never had that experience. Or if I had, I'd forgotten. I said, hi, I'm Brendan, nice to meet you. He goes, are you new? I said, no, I'm not new. I've been here a bunch, you know, 12, 13 years sober, I'm fine. And why would you ask that? Do I look new? And then Bob H, you know, Bob is a big dude, oxygen mask, and hey, I'm Bob. I'm like, hey, Bob, how you doing? Nice to meet you. And when I came back the next week, they remembered my name. And that was it, man. And that became my home group. I became the GSR for that home group. I found my first true sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous in that home group. A guy named Terry T. And I liked Terry because he rode motorcycles, and we could sit and have coffee and talk about girls. I didn't know anything about girls, but Terry did. I was married. So I got to hear about girls from Terry, and we read a little bit out of the book, but that was the best I could stand, man. And it was good. And then Mike D became my sponsor, and he stayed my sponsor until he moved out of the state, or until he moved to the east side of the state. And, you know, he was the first man I ever sat down and actually worked through the book with. And, you know, when I asked him to sponsor me, he kind of looked at me like, yeah, that'd be great. Yeah. Because you're so clearly insane. I went to that meeting every week, and they had a step study in one of the sections, and it was the eighth step or the ninth step. I don't recall which one it was. We were talking about amends, obviously. And I got called on. Now, this didn't happen. Gotcha, 15 minutes, cool. This didn't happen all that often because, you know, but it wasn't they called on me. I was the next person in line. So they kind of were like, we can't skip over that guy. Let's hear what he has to say. And I talked about I had just gotten a new job, and the job required me to not steal from my employer. And I didn't really understand what that meant, right? Because I'd had a job before that I stole from my employer, right? I was sober, you know, sold weapons illegally. I just did this just crazy shit, right? And I didn't know what to do. And so I went into this meeting, and I got called on, and I spoke, and I said, I don't know what honesty actually means. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't have any experience with that. I think you're all full of shit. And, you know, I'd spoken in that meeting before, and everybody went like this when they would see me. I'd be like, hey, and they'd walk around me, right? Because, you know, it's just like vibrating with rage. And people came up and talked to me. And it really pissed me off because it was like, look, you know, I'm crying, I pants myself in a meeting, and now you want to talk to me. Before, I had a great tight pitch about how the world should be, and you didn't give a shit. And I was really upset by that, you know? It was probably the first time I'd told the truth in a really long time. And so, you know, as I said, that became my home group. At the time, Roy and Carol went to that meeting all the time, and Carol was a home group member, and I became the GSR. So I got Bob H. and Carol. If you knew those two people, that's a rough crowd to work with, man. And so I ran the business meeting. Carol goes, you know, I like the way you run the business meeting. And that mattered to me. I don't know why, but it did. And I was like, she's like, you keep it on pace, right? And I was like, oh. And that was my first introduction to service, right? And I went to, you know, district and represented my home group. And it was fantastic. I didn't miss that meeting. When my son was born, we would take him to the meeting with us, right? He's a little ball of fur, and we'd pass him around the meeting, and they embraced us, right? And man, that was magic. That was absolutely magic for me. And that stayed my home group until we couldn't make it on Thursday nights because we had a kid now, and it was difficult, and we'd moved over to where we live now in North Seattle, and you know, and life got big, man. We lost a kid in between our two children, and that devastated me. And then my daughter was born, and that devastated me because I didn't want a girl. I didn't know what to do with a girl. I'm like, what do you do with a girl? You know, I know what to do with a boy kid. You teach him how to ride motorcycles and shoot guns and shit, but what do you do with a girl? Turns out my daughter actually likes motorcycles and guns. My son, he's an engineering student. He's kind of like, Dad, you're a little weird, you know? So my baby girl is, you know, 190 pounds, and she wrestles on the girls' team, you know? So you never know what you're going to get. So, you know, but that period of time, I lost my mind again. And because I know how to raise kids. I didn't really have any parenting skills, and hadn't really been taught many parenting skills, and was too afraid to ask for help, you know? So here I am. At that point, I'm around 20 years sober. And so my solution was I just kept eating, right? I kept eating and kept chewing, you know, which are two substances. I love tobacco and I love to eat. And then when I stopped doing that, shit got real bad because I wasn't medicating myself anymore, you know? And again, I don't have any judgment on how people eat or whether you smile. I don't give a shit about that. But for me, that was stuff that was, you know, it wasn't killing me immediately, but it was certainly killing me. And so, you know, I got fit because I thought, that's what the solution is. I'll get fit. You know, I'm still sponsoring guys. I'm still going to meetings. I'm still working with a sponsor. But, you know, inside, I'm just tore up. And because I don't know what to do and I don't know how to ask for help. And so, you know, I'm fit. I'm 40 years old. I'm fit. Everything's good. I'm fine. I got two kids. Wife's a doc. Everything's good. And I'm just dying, right? And I ended up having a disagreement with my wife, which was a daily occurrence. I end up curled up on the floor, crying, shaking, and I can't get off the floor, and I don't know what to do, right? Because I'm like, I'm trying to put my socks on. I'm convinced if I get my socks on and get up off the floor, everything will be fine, and I can just go back to doing what I do every day, which is, you know, go to meetings, be a service, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But I can't get up, right? And my wife had to call my work and say I wouldn't be in that day, you know, and I didn't miss work for anything, You know, not for a kid being sick, not for anything. Because there's one thing that I could always do. I'd learned that in Alaska. I could always do that. I could always show up for work. And turns out I was diagnosed with, you know, all the shit I thought I got away with, all the trauma, all the stuff. I got diagnosed with PTSD. And I'm like, really? That's some bullshit, you know. And the therapist is like, no, you have PTSD. I'm like, I don't know how you're still alive. Like, people that have what you have, the way you have it, usually die. And I was like, yeah, well, you're full of shit. And she said, if you don't get some help with that, you're not going to make it. And I was like, yeah, okay. Like, you know, what do you know? You spent, you know, 25 years learning your craft. I've spent 10 minutes knowing my craft, so, you know, we're good. I read a book about it. We're fine. And you know, for me, that had to get dealt with. And so I dealt with it, you know. Not what I was expecting, man. You know, I rode motorcycles. I have tattoos. I'm tough, you know. Married to a hot chick, got two good kids, own a house. None of this shit's happening to me, you know. What does this have to do with Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? Why am I, you know, how do you talk about this in an AA meeting, you know? Turns out when I started talking about it, not in AA meetings all that frequently, you know, usually I'll talk about it a little bit from the podium because it's part of my story, you know. I had to get some help with that, you know. That rage and all that stuff that I thought I got away with. You know, I'd worked the steps multiple times and it didn't go away. You know, it turns out that they have actually professional treatment for shit like that. Who knew? You know, you don't take your car to the guy next door who runs a lawnmower repair shop to get your car fixed. You take it to a car shop. You take it to somebody that knows what they're doing, you know? And that was hugely ego deflating for me because I had this. That was always my answer. I have this. Don't worry about it. I got it. You know, I've worked the steps. I've done my amends. You know, I work with other guys. I don't need your help. And it turns out I needed some help, you know. My wife went to Al-Anon starting at that time because she couldn't stand me. She's like, you're like living with an active alcoholic. And later on, you know, when that passed or when that got dealt with, you know, she sat down and had a conversation with me. It went something like this. I would have left you if I had enough money and didn't think you were going to kill yourself. And you want a humbling experience is have the woman you've been with at that point for 25 years, 20 years, look at you and say, I don't want to leave my kids without a dad, so I put up with your shit, you know? And I was like, whoa, what is that? You know, so I went back to the program, right? Because I got the PTSD treatment dealt with, but all the wreckage I'd caused during that period of time, I still had to deal with that. You know, so I got to work the steps again a couple of times and do more amends and do another fourth and fifth step and make amends to my kids because this program continues. That's the thing that I know. You know, I don't know much. I really don't. But after 37 years in this program, I know that the program continues to work as long as I'm open to it, as long as I'm willing to take the risk and ask for help. You know, during COVID, a couple of guys started a book study, right, where we could be socially distant. At Intergroup, and it was 10 guys, and we met every second Thursday, all through COVID. And man, it saved my life. You know, four or five of those guys are here right now. You know, and I found my litter mates. I found my tribe again. You know, I found people I could understand and I could communicate with. You know, so for me, this program continues every day. You know, a couple years ago, I discovered the third step. Did you know that's a step? It's so amazing. Was coming back from Texas, visiting my sister, and put on a speaker's tape, not a tape, I know. It's an audio book, but whatever, it's tape. This guy starts talking about their step. I don't like his tone of voice. I don't like his preachy manner. And so I'm like, I've got a couple hours to rage. Let's just drive across East Texas and listen to this asshole talk. And again, it was that magic moment. It just changed my mind. You know, that psychic change that we talk about. It's just a change of mind. You know, my mind gets a crack in it, and God can come in, and you know. And so I found the third step for the first time, you know. And I found it when I needed it, you know. So for me, this is how this program works: is I find it when I need it. I don't get it when I want it, which is really disappointing, you know. Somebody told me once, if you ever got what you wanted, you wouldn't know what the fuck to do with yourself, you know. You get what you need, and you get what you get, and that's been my experience, you know. So. I love this program with all my heart, right? I'm a student of it. It fascinates me, you know? Sitting in a meeting and listening to people talk about how their life works, you know, what the, how the magic happens for them. Man, it's never boring. You know, I go to meetings, I travel a lot for work, so I go to meetings all over the place. You know, I was in a meeting at Pacific Beach a couple weeks ago. I walk in, it's like four guys. I'm like, oh, it's gonna be that meeting, you know. One of the dudes is snoring, and I'm not kidding, he was snoring before the meeting. And it was a great meeting, you know. The guy chairing the meeting is a couple months sober. Everybody else has got like 20 plus years. I mean, the wisdom laid down was just startling and exactly what I needed that morning, you know. So, you know, if you're new, welcome. You know, and new is, you know, new for me happened a bunch of different times in my sobriety, you know. If you're like me and you're suffering, you know, and you're in pain and this sucks, you know, there's good news. There's a way out of it, you know. There's bad news. It's the same way that worked the first time and the second time and the third time. The difference, the program doesn't change, but I did. You know, I changed. So each time I came to those jumping off places, when suicide and, you know, picking up looked like a good idea, for me, it's the only solution that I have is God kind of opened a crack and something could come in, you know. And it's never what I thought it would be. Never, no motorcycle, I've known 90 of them, ever fixed the problem. You know, buying shit with money I don't have for people I don't like didn't fix the problem, you know. Sitting down with another man and talking honestly, that doesn't fix the problem, but man, it's a whole lot less lonely. So grateful to be here, grateful for my time. Thank you.